This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Five hundred years ago, on Shrove Tuesday, the 4th of March, 1522, Anne Boleyn made her first recorded debut at the English court. She'd returned from France sometime in late 1521, having been at the court of Francis I since 1515, and before that at the court of Margaret of Austria in Mechelen in the Low Countries. At these courts, she would have become familiar with Renaissance masks and courtly entertainments. When she returned to England, she joined the household of the Queen, Catherine of Aragon, and as one of her ladies, took part in one of these familiar masks or pageants called the Chateau Vert or the Green Castle. Here's how the chronicler Edward Hall describes it. On Shrove Tuesday at night, the cardinal, the king, the ambassadors made another supper, and after supper they came into a great chamber hanged with arras. And at the nether end of the same chamber was a castle, in which was a principal tower, and two less towers stood on every side, warded and embattled. And on every tower was a banner. And this castle was kept with ladies of strange names, the first Beauty, the second Honour, the third Perseverance, the fourth Kindness, the fifth Constance, the sixth Bounty, the seventh Mercy, and the eighth Pity. These eight ladies had Milan gowns of white satin. Every lady had her name embroidered with gold on their head cores, and Milan bonnets of gold with jewels. Underneath the base fortress of the castle were eight other ladies, whose names were Danger, Disdain, Jealousy, Unkindness, Scorn, Malbouche, Strangeness. Then entered eight lords in cloth of gold caps and all, and great mantles of blue satin, and these lords were named Amorous, Nobleness, Youth, Attendance, Loyalty, Pleasure, Gentleness, and Liberty. The king was chief of this company. Then the lords ran to the castle, and the ladies defended the castle with rose water and comfits, and the lords threw in dates and oranges and other fruits made for pleasure, but at last the place was won. Then the lords took the ladies of honour as prisoners by the hands and brought them down and danced together very pleasantly. Among these ladies, the part of Perseverance, or what we would call Perseverance, was Anne. To mark this anniversary, Hever Castle have opened a new exhibition exploring Anne's formation to 1522. It's called Becoming Anne, Connections, Culture, Court. And I went to Hever to speak to its creators, Dr. Owen Emerson and Kate McCaffrey. It is a delight to be sat in Hever Castle with Kate McCaffrey and Dr. Owen Emerson to be talking about their new exhibition and a new book. What did you want to try and achieve with this exhibition?
Yes, as you say, we really wanted to celebrate the anniversary of Anne's first recorded debut back in England. And we wanted to use that as an opportunity to examine her life up until that point. The end to Anne's story is very well known, as is her time at the English court, but her life before that point, her childhood, her youth, her early education, is very rarely celebrated. So I think we really wanted to use this anniversary to highlight all the different facets and factors that made Anne into the incredible, intelligent, cultured woman and courtier who took England by storm 500 years ago.
Owen, you wrote a book with Claire Ridgway called The Boleyns of Hever Castle, and we're here in Anne's childhood home. Tell us about the Boleyn family.
The Boleyns are very well associated with Hever, but we know that they didn't originate from here. We can trace them to Norfolk, and they weren't the most noble family at court, but they had done incredibly well. So over three generations, they had amassed enormous wealth and fortune and solidified their accomplishments by marrying very advantageously. So there are a number of very good marriages into the nobility. And Thomas Boleyn is, I would say, a pivotal character. He is a gifted linguist. He's a humanist. And he provides very good opportunities for all of his children.
Now, Anne was one of several siblings. Some didn't survive to adulthood, but there are three that did. And one of the items in your exhibition is a dedication by her brother George Boleyn to Anne. What does this tell us about the relationship between the siblings?
I think it tells us a huge amount, actually. I think they were incredibly close, and I think they shared values and also shared a great bond and love. I think we know less, perhaps, about the relationship between George, Mary and Anne, because Mary is a slightly more opaque character in the records. We only really have one letter of Mary's in her own words. But what that letter does show us is that she is very well educated. She is a determined individual. She's very Boleyn. And I think the siblings were as thick as thieves, to be honest. Challenged each other in terms of culture and faith. And they weren't averse to falling out. There were several famous altercations. But I think they were very similar in many ways.
I like the idea that Boleyn might become an adjective. Very Boleyn is to someone's brilliant and fiery and opinionated. Kate, you have in the collection here at Hever Castle portraits of many, actually, of Henry VIII's wives, but particularly of Anne and of Mary. And one of the items in your exhibition is an amazing reconstruction of a dress that Anne is wearing in one of those portraits. Tell us about that and about the decision to recreate it.
Yes, we're really lucky to have on loan, as you say, a beautiful reconstruction of a dress that Anne is wearing in what used to be Inner Hall portraits. It's now been moved up to what was supposedly once Anne's bedroom. It's a sketch after Holbein, and in it Anne is depicted wearing a gable hood, which is perhaps not the most obviously Anne of clothing. She usually is seen to have favoured the kind of French fashions, the French hood, which showed her hair and was seen as a bit more risque. But in this drawing and in this portrait, she is depicted in the more English fashions. And so we thought it was really interesting to have this reconstruction, which has been generously loaned by Karen Davies and Samantha Rees, who created it, and just beautifully demonstrates the kinds of fashions that Anne also would have been wearing. Obviously, she was greatly inspired by her time in France, but she wasn't limited to only their fashions. And it's likely when she did arrive back in England, she also adopted the English fashions as well.
And that takes us to what we know of her formation. So we call this her childhood home. How many years do we think that she was probably living here as a child?
It's very likely that all of the Boleyn children moved here in 1505. Depending on when you think Anne was born, that would mean she was either born here or in Blickling in Norfolk. I believe she was born in Norfolk. And it's likely that she remained here until 1513. And she probably wouldn't have seen much of Hever before she returned to the English court. But we know that Hever really comes into its own during the courtship years. This sort of acts as Anne's safety valve, her private sanctum, where she can escape the heat of scandal at court and be private and perhaps do some planning and receiving of correspondence.
And I think surely the fact that she was here from what you and I are in agreement was probably about the age of 4 to the age of 12, 13 is quite important in terms of creating that image in her head of this being home and this being the place of her childhood security, don't you think?
Yeah, I think very much that's why we love the phrase childhood home, because I think this does seem to be a place that Anne would have known fondly as a child, and it makes sense that then she returned here in her adulthood during the struggles and turmoil of court life, that she would seek refuge back at this place that she felt safe and was home for her.
Now, you mentioned the controversy over when she was born, and a key piece of evidence in that is a letter that she sent to her father from Laveur in Mechelen near Brussels, where she had gone to spend time with Margaret of Austria. And then after that, 18 months later or so, she's off to be in France. Let's talk about that letter, because you've got a copy of it as part of your exhibition. What does it tell us about Anne?
I think it tells us a huge amount about Anne at this time. It's a really beautiful letter in terms of sentiment to her father. I think it shows a real love for him, actually, and it recognises how important Thomas has been in her education before she arrived at Margaret's court, and how keen Anne was to maintain a level of education that was perhaps expected of her. She talks in the letter about the orthography of her letter. She apologises for the spelling, but I love the fact that she wants him to be assured that they are her words, that this is her effort. And she indicates that previous correspondence she's had help with from Simonette, but this letter is her understanding. And I think it's a really remarkable survival, actually, because we don't have any correspondence from Anne for quite some years after. And I think the fact that it was kept, it must have been kept, I think, by Thomas. When I saw it in the flesh, it's still got very defined crease lines, and I feel it must have been kept for a reason. I think there must have been perhaps some pride on the part of Thomas for her composition of this letter. So yes, it's a really vivid insight into Anne, and it's lovely to have it here.
And we haven't mentioned that it's actually written in French. Kate, this speaks to the education that she had along with her siblings, an education really fine for a woman of her age, and her attempts to impress her father. It is very sweet.
I think so. The fact that Anne so is desperately trying to impress her father shows as well the kind of full hopes and expectations that were probably on her as this 12 or 13-year-old who goes to Mechelen, to this very prestigious court of Margaret of Austria, where the royal nieces and nephews of Margaret are being educated, so she's really amongst such elite families of Europe. And so for the Boleyns to have her there in the first place, orchestrated by Thomas and his professional and personal relationship with Margaret, I think is a huge testimony to him, but also I'm sure Anne felt that pressure to perform for her father and to make the most of the experiences, and I think she obviously really does and goes on to the French court next and continues to impress.
So she was dispatched to France in order to serve Henry VIII's sister, Mary, when she had become Queen of France. It doesn't last very long. And then most of the ladies go home, but Anne stays with Claude of France. And in your exhibition, you have a series of miniatures which speak to Anne's time in France. Can you tell me about those and what they indicate about what we know of Anne's experiences?
Yes, so the miniatures, which were graciously loaned by Owen for the exhibition, are wonderful to have on display, and they show some real key players during her time spent in France. So we have figures such as Claude of France, who, as you mentioned, Anne went into her service. She was the Queen of France, married to Francis I. We also have Marguerite d'Angoulême, who was the sister of Francis I. We have Francis himself, and we have Louise of Savoy, who was the king's mother. She really was a power behind the throne. And I think particularly through these women that Anne was surrounded by in France, I think she must have taken so much inspiration from them, all in different ways. I think Claude, perhaps, she learnt less about leadership and politics from, because Claude was constantly pregnant and quite shy and timid. But I think from Claude, Anne would have been exposed to a lot of art and culture and literature, which we really see she takes forward. Through Louise of Savoy, we see, I think, Anne's inspired by her female use of authority, the kind of wielding of political authority by a woman. And through Marguerite, I think Anne takes a lot of inspiration in terms of her religion. Marguerite was a famous patron of religious reform, which we obviously see Anne also carry through in her lifetime.
Did Edison really take credit for things he didn't invent? Were treadmills originally a form of corporal punishment? And would man have ever got to the moon without the bra? You can expect answers to all these questions and more in the brand new podcast from History Hit, patented History of Inventions. Join me, Dallas Campbell, as I uncover what really sparked history's most impactful ideas. Each episode, I'll be recruiting the help of experts, scientists, historians, and even a few real-life inventors. Subscribe to Patented History of Inventions wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Join us this month on Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Matt Lewis.
And I'm Eleanor Yonaga. This April, dive into our special mini-series.
With the help of leading experts, we're tracing the foundations of England by exploring the country's most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
We'll be looking at Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex, as well as the rulers and their councils who helped shape a nation.
Make sure to get every episode by listening and following Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Anne's faith, of course, will become very important in the story of her life and indeed of this country's history. But actually, the books that you have here speak in the first place to some of the conservative background of faith. They are beautiful things, though. Owen, tell me about the Books of Hours that you have here.
I think they are the treasures of our collection. And they send shivers down my spine. But you're right, they do talk to the complex nature, should we say, of Anne's own individual faith. The first of the books is a manuscript, and it was created in Bruges, circa 1410 to 1450. So this is likely a hand-me-down book. This is very common. It was probably handed down to her from someone like her mother, Elizabeth Howard, or even her grandmother, Lady Margaret Butler. It's handwritten, hand-illuminated, and you're right, it's a traditionally Catholic text. So I think both of our books can give us access to Anne's developing religious ideas, and I'm going to let Kate talk to you about the second Book of Hours because she has done some incredible research into it.
Yes, Kate, you've come on this podcast before, and anybody who hasn't heard that episode with Kate talking all about her research must go and have a listen. But remind us of what you found in the printed Book of Hours.
Yes, so I was lucky enough to work with the printed Book of Hours for my MA thesis a couple of years ago, and I uncovered four further inscriptions within the book that weren't previously known to be there. So it was previously thought to contain only one note, which is Anne's famous rhyming couplet, "Remember me when you do pray, that hope doth lead from day to day." But that was thought to be the only note within it, and I found four further inscriptions from various noble families who also lived around Hever, so again local to the kind of Kent area where Anne grew up. And yeah, in terms of her religious development and the books, I think they are really interesting because, as Owen said, they're traditionally Catholic texts. They're written in Latin predominantly. But some of my work with the printed book showed the kind of tactile nature of prayer at this time. Obviously, people were feeling the pages as they prayed. They were rubbing the illuminations, rubbing the words as they engaged with them. And actually, we do have English prayers in our printed Book of Hours, which is not uncommon for the time, but is interesting knowing Anne's passion for the written in the vernacular and for religious texts. And actually, compared to other copies of this same printing, the English prayers within Anne's book are incredibly worn, which suggests that she was engaging with them more so than the traditionally Catholic Latin prayers.
Well, that's really interesting. And also that it was a book that was printed in France. It's from 1528, is that right?
27. Yes.
So it has been produced for an English market with these English prayers in, but it's in France that we've got this kind of innovative printing of liturgy in English.
Yeah, it's really interesting as well because Germain Hardouin, who's the printer, he very rarely printed for an English audience. And actually, this book is the first example that I've found of him printing for use of Sarum, so for people in England. And I have to speculate whether Anne had something to do with the commissioning of these books. Obviously, having spent 7 years in France, being around religious literature such as this, and then suddenly Hardouin deciding at 1527-28, which is such a pivotal moment for Anne, rising at the English court, he suddenly decides to print for the English court in English with prayers. It's an interesting connection that I'm definitely exploring further.
Now, we've talked about the influence of various people in France in terms of her religion, but what other sort of skills and qualities did Anne acquire in her time on the continent that she brought back to England in 1521-1522?
I think if we look at her love of art and culture, I think we have to appreciate how rich it was in France. We know, for example, Claude loved portrait miniatures. We know that she was a patron to artists, as was Francis. So when Anne arrives back at the English court, people do, you know, quip that she could have been mistaken for a French woman. So from that, perhaps we can assume that she is initially perhaps adopting the French fashions, that she perhaps has an air about her, maybe even has adopted a French accent. I think she must have looked and felt different. And we know that Anne isn't the best looking woman in a room, perhaps, but there is so much more to her than that. And she has, I would say, a very fine intellect. She can command the attention of a room. And when things do get very heated at court, even her adversaries can't stop looking and listening and reporting everything she says. I think there was something magnetic about her. And I think that came from her time abroad.
Yes, she was clearly brilliant in the sense of having very fine mind, being very good at wordplay and wit, but also in the sense that she dazzled. She clearly was charismatic in that way that film stars can be. They just walk in and every head turns to look at them, whether they're good looking or not. That seems to have been Anne's characteristics from everything that's been written about her.
She reminds me a bit, actually, of Wallis Simpson, in that she divided opinion like no one else. People either loved or loathed her. She had great style. We know, for example, lovely little detail from the Chateau Vert that Anne actually keeps her dress, for example, whereas other players don't. I think she had something about her that it didn't matter whether you loved or disliked her. You had to keep watching and people were fascinated by her.
Now, she was coming back to serve a Spanish queen, who was Queen of England at the time, also a glittering woman, Catherine of Aragon. And one of the items in your exhibition is a portrait that has hitherto been identified as Catherine Parr, but in this exhibition you are asserting that it's actually Catherine of Aragon. Talk us through that decision.
Yes, so we acquired this specific portrait back in 2004, and it was labelled then in good faith as Catherine Parr. There's still some historic debate about the identity of the portrait, but we are renaming her as Catherine of Aragon for this exhibition, and that is primarily due to the research that has been undertaken by the National Portrait Gallery into the Lambeth Palace portrait, which is the same version as our one, and they dated that portrait to circa 1520, which would make Catherine Parr at that point only 8 years old. So it seems far too young to be Catherine Parr, and actually looks more likely to be Catherine of Aragon. And what's exciting about that date for us with this exhibition is that this is the face of Catherine of Aragon that Anne would have gazed upon and seen and been in service to when she returned to the court 500 years ago.
So let's get to that moment then, the moment where we first see Anne Boleyn at the English court in the sources. She was probably there before, but when she first appears in the sources is in March 1522. And in what is she appearing?
So Anne is making her debut in a pageant, and it's a Shrovetide feast, shall we say. It's a number of events, and there is a theme throughout the pageant of unrequited love. And the culmination takes place in Cardinal Wolsey's great chamber at York Place, and plays the role of Perseverance in this pageant. And essentially, there are virtues that are being kept prisoner in a green castle, and they are held captive by vices, and Henry VIII and his men charge in, pelting the vices with sugar plums. And to the sound of gunfire from outside, they liberate the virtues from the tower.
Henry VIII clearly does think he's a medieval knight. Sugar plums or not, there they are, getting rid of the evil ones and saving the women. But interestingly, there are lots of virtues, aren't there? Beauty and kindness and honesty. Anne isn't chosen to play any of those. She's chosen to play Perseverance or Perseverance, which of course will turn out to be historically very apt indeed.
It really is. It couldn't be better casting, really, could it? And there's some interesting casting as well. We've got Jane Parker playing the role of Constancy, which to previous historians may have sounded ironic because she was always marked as the betrayer of the Boleyns. But there's been something of a renaissance in the study of her history. And actually, I think her casting was rather apt too. I think she was a rather loyal wife rather than the great betrayer. So yeah, some great casting that day.
Yes, so we've also got Kindness is another one, which was played by Anne's sister Mary, which I think probably also is quite an apt casting. I think all we know of Mary, she seems to have been rather gentle and loyal and kind. And then you also have Beauty, I think, is another famous one, who was played by now the Dowager Queen of France, Henry VIII's sister, Mary. And obviously she becomes quite an enemy of sorts. She doesn't approve of Anne's relationship with her brother going forward. And I think that's what we always think is interesting about the Chateau Vert pageant, is you have all these key players in the room at the same time, not knowing over the course of the next decade how positions are going to change. So it's a really exciting moment.
And among those must have been, I would have thought, Catherine of Aragon, because this is all done for imperial ambassadors, isn't it? So, as you say, everybody who's going to be on the list of dramatis personae of importance over the next decade is there.
The stage and it's all is set.
Ready to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much for talking to me about this exhibition of yours, which is one of the first that Hever has done.
Yeah, first in a long time. Yeah, it's a really welcome addition to the visitor route. And
it will be the first in a series of exhibitions over the next few years.
So. I think Kate is saying that just to get it on record, so it has to happen.
So it has to happen now. So watch out.
And it's certainly worth coming to see all sorts of wonderful goodies here. And it's ever a pleasure to be here. So thank you for welcoming me once again. And do everybody come and pick up a copy of Kate and Owen's book, Becoming Anne.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jouissance vous dans l'oreille by Claudin de Sermessy, sung there by Jay Britton, who I spied earlier dressed as Anne Boleyn and singing beautifully live in the inner hall at Hever Castle. Thanks to Jay for that. And thank you so much for listening to Not Just the Tudors. And there's plenty more on Anne Boleyn, where that came from. We now have almost 100 podcasts that we've created since last April, all available for you to listen to again, or even discover for the first time, wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also have your additional weekly booster jab with our Tudor Tuesday newsletter, with news of History Hit's best podcasts, articles, and films. Find out more at historyhit.com.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.